This is The Rundown. I'm Hari Srinivasan. I'm joined by William Dobson, who is working on a book about dictators, and also what caught our eye this last week is a series of blog posts that you'd written for The Washington Post under Dictator Watch. But you were just in Egypt, and you were there on the eve of these elections. So I think really now that the results are out, if you could help folks understand what happened there. There was this enormous push for change, and then all of a sudden there's different interpretations of exactly what this vote means.
That's right. I mean, the situation in Cairo and in Egypt writ large is extremely fluid. I mean, that's the first thing. Everyone is sort of trying to second guess and figure out and decode what is going on. You have a process that's being run by the military. Now that, for some people, is a very good thing. The military is the only institution in Egypt that people really ever had much respect for. But on the other hand, they were chief beneficiaries of the previous system. Generals have done very well under Mubarak for the past 30 years. And so many people would raise reasonable questions as to what is their vested interest and how this process that Egypt is in now turns out. Yes, they're sort of supposed to be guardians of a democratic process, but won't they really have their fingers on the scale in terms of who comes next? Why would they want a complete newcomer or for that matter, a true Democrat to be the next president of Egypt when they might prefer someone who they know much better? So you have a process that's moving extremely quickly. Now, why does that matter? That matters because a process that moves quickly benefits those who are already politically organized. In Egypt, that really means two groups. That means the Muslim Brotherhood, and that means the remnants of the old regime. Those are the two entities that really had the political infrastructure to be able to organize around elections. And so many look at this, particularly the students and youth who were active in Tahrir Square, as being the beginning of the end of the revolution.
So really, is it a literacy versus illiteracy correlation? In one of your blog posts you were talking about, or is it a certainty versus uncertainty?
Well, I mean, it is true. If you actually look at illiteracy in Egypt, it correlated very strongly with whether or not you voted yes or no. So the areas where there's the greatest levels of literacy, you can also then safely say those are the areas that are poorest and most rural. They were strongly in support of the referendum. That said, again, the same logic I brought up still is true. They could just want a return to the economy. But at the same time, they couldn't read the constitutional amendments for themselves. So that could suggest, you could say, that maybe they were being told how to vote. Maybe they were being incentivized how to vote. I mean, in the bad old days of the Mubarak regime, your vote was bought for the equivalent of 10 pounds, which is a little bit more than a US dollar or a bag of sugar. Are those things still at play? You know, it could be true in one government and not in another.
And then finally, kind of in the bigger picture of the region, one of your columns was talking about, is this the fourth wave? And how do we figure that out?
Well, I mean, this idea of democratic waves is something that the late political scientist Samuel Huntington would talk about. And he identified the third wave, the last big democratic wave, as beginning in 1974 and going to 1990. And he had many, many different factors sort of looking at why that was the case. Now, what we're seeing right now is this dramatic sort of boiling over in this region. And so you see a density of change going on. There's a critical mass that makes people wonder, is this a wave? It might be, but we don't know for sure. The thing that we have to ask, though, is why is this happening now? What is making this happen in such a quick timetable? Because what Huntington was describing was 15 years. We're not talking about 15 weeks yet. So what is that? And for me, I think it's one of the factors that Huntington identified, which is the idea of demonstration effects. That if I see you do something over there and you succeed, it makes me want to do it. Those things were true in the period of 74 to 90, but not nearly as instantaneous as what we find today, when these people were all following each other's movements on Facebook, on YouTube, on CNN or Al Jazeera. So they're following these things on cable news networks and what have you, and they're moving very quickly. So the one thing I could say for sure is that if this is a wave or not, we'll probably know sooner than later.
Do you think that the dictators also have that demonstration effect where they see what's happening to the guy next door?
Absolutely.
Either in the case of Yemen or Libya or Egypt or Tunisia?
Well, it's absolutely. I mean, the dictators are learning very quickly, too. And so this is a very dynamic, active process. I mean, look at it this way. No one is responding. None of the regimes that are currently under revolt are responding the same way that Tunisia and Egypt did. Why? Because those represent abject failures from the point of view of a dictator. So what we've been seeing is a real quick pace of cracking down. And they're using force much quicker than the earlier regimes that face these struggles because they don't want to end up in exile.
All right. Plenty more about that in your book and some of your columns for the Washington Post under the headline Dictator Watch, right?
Yeah, that's right.
William Dobson, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
This is The Rundown. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Stay with us.